Let's go ahead and begin the 44th week of our 4.5 year journey through all of God's inspired word by turning to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Remember, Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to the Israeli people there on the plains of Moab in the 11th month of the 40th year of the Exodus experience. He will be dying soon, and so he is trying to review as much of the legal material as he possibly can with his students before he passes away and they move on into the Promised Land. So some of this is repeated material from Exodus or Leviticus, some in Numbers, but some of it is newer information that is only in the book of Deuteronomy. And that's why the book of Deuteronomy is so important to the Jewish nation as they move forward. In Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, we have a simple command that becomes the basis for two passages in the New Testament about paying your preacher, which, since I am a full-time worker in the kingdom, I most certainly appreciate the application of this passage. So let's look, first of all, at the simple part of it. Deuteronomy 25, 4. You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. Now, the idea is they would use animal power for processing their grain. So they might harness up an ox to a threshing sledge, which would then go back and forth over the stalks of grain in order to break it loose from its chaff, the husk and the stalk, so that the kernels would be able to be winnowed away from all of that chaff. So sometimes they would put the animal on a revolving arrangement, harness it up to a post that was on a pivot point, and just go around and round and round in circles. Well, you need to feed your ox in order to get it the muscle power it needs to do this work. So why feed it separately from the work it's doing? Just don't muzzle its face. Allow it enough slack that it can, from time to time, pause in its work and bend down with its neck and just eat some of the grain product that it is treading out. It was a very practical thing, and actually it's almost kind of a duh thing when it comes to just the process of production of grain. Now, how, though, is it produced, or how, though, is it applied in the New Testament? I want to take you to the two places where the Apostle Paul utilizes it. The first is in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where he is defending his apostleship, how he has certain rights which he chooses not always to exercise, but he still has them. And this is what he writes to the Corinthians. Verse 3, this is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink, meaning from ministry funds? Verse 5, do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Now, Cephas is Peter. So Peter and the other apostles were apparently married. That was the norm of that time period. And they were traveling around with their family, with their wives, and were apparently being supported out of ministry funds, their entire family. The brothers of the Lord, two that we know very well from the New Testament, would be James, the author of the letter of James, and Jude, the author of the letter of Jude. They apparently were also ministry workers, and they had wives, perhaps kids, traveling with them, and they had the right, as ministry workers, to be supported out of ministry funds. Verse 6. Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? And again, you can see the context is all about if you're working for the Lord's ministry, then some of the ministry funds coming in should feed and clothe and house you, to basically pay for your life. And he says, are you suggesting, seriously, that Barnabas and I have zero right to that sort of support when all the other people who are working in the ministry do have it? Then he gives these obvious cultural connections. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? And the answer is none of them. Even officers who do pay for certain parts of their upkeep, such as their uniform, they still get a salary. They still get paid in order to do the work of a military person. Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Not going to happen. Or who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? That was just the norm. When you worked in a certain area, the produce was something that you could benefit from personally. And then he comes to the passage we were just looking at. Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? And actually, the thrust is it only about oxen that God is concerned? Does he only care about oxen that are working hard and they ought to be paid with a decent meal from the very thing they're working on? Verse 10, does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we've sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share this rightful claim on you, do we not even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right. And so then Paul goes on to explain, we have the legitimate biblical right to ask you to pay us out of ministry funds because we're working for the Lord. But for reasons of our own, which he then goes into, I'm not making use of that right. Now that's different than not having the right at all. And so this passage, along with the next passage we're going to go to in Timothy, this would be 1 Timothy 5, are clear indications that those who work in ministry for the Lord should be paid out of ministry funds. 1 Timothy 5, verse number 17. Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages. Now that second quote, it's actually a principle that comes from several passages that basically if somebody works for you, you owe them payment. Don't hold back on it or God will take it under advisement against you. So Paul says, look, if you've got elders, spiritual leaders in the church, that their full-time work, they're sweating themselves doing the preaching and the teaching, you need to be paying them out of your ministry funds because that's fair. Just like it was fair to let your ox eat some of the grain it was threshing. So just an interesting application from a very simple passage in the Old Testament, but utilized by Paul in two places in the New Testament. Make sure in your home congregation that you are feeding your spiritual ox well. Don't starve him to death. Make sure that there are enough ministry funds devoted to his care and upkeep that your preacher doesn't start wandering off somewhere else to look for support. So take care of that, all right? Next part of Deuteronomy chapter 25. 25:5, change of topic. And with this one, we have to kind of separate ourselves from our own personal, modern, cultural norm. It is normal in our culture that each person pretty much makes up their own mind who they're going to get married to. In the culture of the ancient world, and actually the culture of most periods in world history, I think, the family was very much involved in decisions of who would be married to whom. It was families allying themselves with other families. And when you're talking about the ancient Israeli culture, it was also people with property getting allied with other people of property and protecting those property rights and the inheritance. Keep in mind that the land of Israel belonged to God, but families had been assigned certain places that they were responsible for and which they would raise the crops on. And so every 50th year, everything was reset back to the original line of inheritance. So that made it even more important that families protected the marriages that happened, which affected the inheritance rights. And so most marriages were arranged between families. That doesn't mean that there wasn't love involved. There was an attraction that was ignored. That could happen. But the families were the ones that made the final determination as to who would get married to whom. So, verse number 5, with all that background, let's look at what happened. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son. So here we have a man who dies without an heir. The wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Now let's make clear some understandings here. The first man that gets married, that was an arranged marriage more than likely. And it would appear that he is the heir that is going to be taking control of the property of the family. But he dies without ever having someone to take that property after him in his family line. So the next unmarried brother in that family is asked by the family to step forward and get married to that widow to keep everything in the family. And their first child is going to be declared the heir of the property of the original husband, the first man who died. Now, all the other children and all the other sons born after that will be considered the heir of the second husband or the second brother. I know this sounds really strange to our Western modern ears, but they were very, very concerned about who was responsible for the land and for inheritance rights. And so that's what this is all about. Verse number 6. The first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, so maybe he's already involved in another relationship that he wants to follow up on. Or maybe he just doesn't feel he likes his brother's widow. If he refuses, it's not just simply a personal preference that we're having a problem with here. It's the fact that he's going against his family's best interests. So verse 7 again, if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders. Remember, the gate of the city is where the legal administrative procedures take place. Things like weddings or the betrothals before the weddings and rites of inheritance. So she's going to take him to court effectively. So she will go to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Now, we've been kind of focusing more on the inheritance here. But now that we're talking about the lady, remember that the lady has also got a stake in this. She has no son to take care of her in her old age. So her social security in that culture is non-existent. So she is basically going to the leaders of the community and saying, this man is not providing the family security that his older brother made to me, promised me, and I'm being mistreated here. And so she brings him up on charges. Verse 8, then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. Basically say, you need to do what is right. You need to do right by your family. You need to do right by this widow. If he persists saying, I don't wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his feet or off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who has his sandal pulled off. So this is a curse. This is a really nasty thing to hang around this guy's neck for the rest of his life, that he is a person who had his sandal ripped off because he wouldn't do the right cultural thing. He disrespected his brother's memory. He disrespected his family's arrangements and the inheritance. He disrespected his brother's widow's social security, her ability to be secure in her old age. And so he's not probably going to be treated well in the community from there on out. So this threat of this pressure is probably what would have caused most of these guys to just go ahead and get married to his brother's widow or make a secondary arrangement on her behalf. Maybe another brother down the line would be willing to do it, or maybe a cousin would be willing to do it. But it's a responsibility of the family, specifically the closest male relative, to do this. Otherwise, he has shamed the whole process. Now, it's interesting to me that in the Middle East, even to this date, it is a shameful thing to have a sandal without a foot in it slapped against you or thrown at you or slapped against a picture of you. There is something about a sandal that is still shaming in the Middle East, and it's probably related to this concept here in the passage. Now, weirdly enough, though, the only clear place that this ceremony happens in the Old Testament is in the book of Ruth. And apparently by that time, it had lost some of its shamefulness, at least in the process that we see. Because you may remember that Ruth had been widowed, and she was looking to get remarried, and Boaz was volunteering to do that, but Boaz was aware that there was a closer relative that could marry her. and redeem the family line property. So they take him to the gate and talk to him about it and say, do you want this property? And he says, yeah, I want the property. And Boaz says, well, you know, if you want the property, you have to marry the widow. And the relative's response was, well, I don't want to marry the widow. And so Boaz says, well, then you need to forfeit any claim to the property as well. And so what does the guy do? He reaches down and he pulls off his sandal and hands it off and says, I give up my forfeiture. I give up my right to the property because I'm not going to marry her. And so for him, it was not that big of a deal. It was just a ceremony momentarily to give up his sandal and then take it back to himself and go about his business. And Boaz would end up marrying Ruth. So just kind of an insight into how this ceremony plays out over time. All right, into Deuteronomy 25:11 now. And this is one of those passages, might be PG-13. Some of you that have kids in the room, you might want to get them busy, turn off the radio or something along that line. It's not that big of a thing, I don't think, but you would end up having a conversation that you might prefer to postpone a little bit longer. So my little verbal dancing there should have given you enough time to take care of the issue. So now let's read the text. When men fight with one another, and it seems like they are in a big brawl, and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him. So we got a fight going on between two guys. One of them seems to be losing. So the wife of the guy decides to jump into the fight as well. And we've all seen this in videos of domestic disputes where you've got more than one person that jumps into the fray. Well, in this case, something inappropriate happens. And she puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts. Now, this is not accidental. She's doing this on purpose. And what is it she's trying to do? She's trying to hurt him. She's trying to crush his genitals. And that is an assault upon a person's future. My guess is that there were already rules understood in the society of Israelis that when you and another guy are fighting, you don't fight dirty and reach out and grab the guy by the genitals and try to crush them and ruin him for life. Because that is not just hurting him personally, it is hurting his family permanently. Two parts of that. If he can't have kids, then his family tree is ended. And number two, if you actually do crush his genitals, he is barred from coming into the tabernacle area for close-up personal worship. So fighting dirty and grabbing a guy by his genitals and crushing them was a very serious assault, and probably the penalty was to have your hand cut off for trying to do this. So what this passage is doing is expanding on that idea. Suppose that instead of one of the guys doing the grabbing and crushing, it's a woman that jumps into the fight and does it. What should be the penalty? And the answer is, apparently, the same penalty for her. Verse 12, then you shall cut off your hand, your eye shall have no pity. Now that line there seems to indicate you might feel more soft-hearted because this is the woman of the family that's trying to jump in and save her husband who's being apparently beaten in the fight. But it doesn't matter. She has done something that is totally inappropriate, something that could, in fact, cut this guy off from a worship relationship with God in close proximity to the tabernacle, or even cut him off from having children. You have to follow through with the penalty for that. All right, verse number 13. You shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small, meaning a light weight so that you can get better value when you're buying something, and a heavy weight so that you can get more stuff whenever you're buying something, because they used weighted things in order to do this. So this is basically the idea of no cheating. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small. A full and fair weight you shall have, a full and fair measure you shall have, that your days may be long in the land that he who is your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who act dishonestly, are an abomination to he who is your God. So God's standard is same standard across the board for everyone. If you try to cheat, God is going to judge you for that. It makes him sick to see people try to take the advantage. And you know, when I'm recording this, we're still in the midst of the presidential election and the counting of all the votes. And I cannot help but apply this passage to the situation. Because people on both sides want to make changes to the benefit of themselves. And it's not fair. It's not right. You should always use the same standard for yourself as you use for someone else, and vice versa. Always. And we as Christians need to stand up and strongly judge those who try to use differing measures based on their own benefits. And that's enough for today. Let's mark our place there, and we'll get back into the Word tomorrow.